Mike, Charlie. Okay, Terry, you're a little bit noisy on the input. There's some hiss, but the audio is about right, and all you have to do is supply them a little bit more RF to this repeater, and you'll be dead full quieting, but you're getting through rather nicely. And there's a... The technical net is in progress right now. Paul, when they bring up water, the oxygen and the hydrogen that's in water, in my opinion, is in an extremely compact form, and water is easy to transport. You don't have to put it into a 6,000 pound per square inch container. So when it comes to bringing up a whole lot of oxygen, would they rather bring it up as water and electrolyze it, or would they rather bring it up as a compressed tank at 6,000 pounds per square inch? I think you get more bang for your money out of bringing up water. That's question number one. And question number two, you talked about bringing up cargo on SpaceX. And so I guess cargo is being brought up on both SpaceX and Progress ships. WS2N, K2LAW.
Question for Paul.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a lot of cargo type ships that are going up, but Orbital ATK, they're anxious to get that up because what happens is you now have a situation where, you know, things are being delayed. You had the explosion with SpaceX, so they're grounded. You have there's other cargo vehicles that have problems too. The Japanese HTV, Japan launches cargo vehicles to the space station. They carry a lot of stuff, like 10,000 pounds of, and that was canceled a month or two ago because they ran a pressure test on the spacecraft itself before they loaded it onto that rocket, and they're working on that. That's been delayed. And then the Soyuz crew was supposed to go up on the 23rd of September. They were canceled because they found a short in one of the landing type of piece of equipment that they need. So they had to take that all apart, and that probably won't go up until another week or two. And that was supposed to go, you know, that's been delayed a couple of months. And because of that, the Progress ship was delayed. That should have gone up. That won't go up until probably December. So there's a lot of delays, and they're anxious to get Antares off the ground from Wild Simon. I know John wanted to say something. Back to you, Dan.
Go right ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Paul, if you know, they bring up water. How do they prevent it from freezing? Is it a thermos container, or is the sun warming that up? I mean, if they bolt that to the outside, wouldn't it freeze? Maybe you have some words on that. KC2WGB.
They got these white bags of water. I mean, yeah, it looks like 100 of them, you know. They used to have the multi-logistics purpose module attached to another part of the space station to the Earth facing down toward the Earth from Unity, and that's where it used to be a big module. I mean, this thing was the originally was a Leonardo multi-purpose logistics module that the shuttle used to bring up and down all the time. It's a big module that they had all kinds of racks on there. They took out and would install in the space station, and then the shuttle would bring this module back down, and this thing went up 3, 4, 5 times over the years. And then on the last flight, they permanently put it in. And where they put it, they need that location for a future berthing location. So they relocated that to the Tranquility module, another node on the space station. But when I was there, and you would see a spacewalk, space tour, where they would you'd go for a tour on the space station, and astronaut would bring it from one end to the other. They always went past this thing, and they would look. look down into it, and there was, it looked like 50 bags, big bags of floating around. That was all their water. Let me drop it. So that's probably what they're doing with it now. They probably relocated all that stuff over to the new location where the it's actually in the forward facing berthing location on the Tranquility module, and that's, you know, it was like their basement, you know, and tons of supplies and stuff, but all these water bags, I you know, it was unbelievable. So that's how they store them. Back to you, John.
Okay, so they're brought inside where they're in the interior atmosphere. All right, very good. Back to you, Dick.
What's your guess, Paul? If you're only concerned about oxygen for the astronauts, do you get more oxygen more easily by bringing it up as water, knowing you're going to do electrolysis to get the oxygen out of it, or are you better off bringing up a great big tank of compressed oxygen? Obviously, they do both, but which one gives them the biggest bang for the dollar is the amount of oxygen that becomes available. It seems to me like the water is a very compact way, because if I take gaseous hydrogen and gaseous oxygen, a cubic meter of both, so to speak, probably 2 cubic meters of hydrogen and 1 cubic meter of oxygen, and when I boil that down to water, I get a hell of a lot less volume than 2 cubic meters. So I think bringing up water is much more efficient volume-wise. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, but, you know, if they need it in a hurry for any kind of reason, like EVAs or some kind of a decompression problem, you know, they want, you know, instant oxygen, you know. So the story on board is, you know, like a one big capacity, you know, they need that to really, you know, supply the spaces. Everything, you know, you wouldn't have the time to convert all the water to the needed oxygen if you needed it real quick. So you need both, and that's why you see these big tanks surrounding the Quest Lab. Quest module is really two rooms in one. You know, the first room you go in, and that's where, you know, they'll get the astronauts ready, dress them up, helmets, suits, and prep them, and then you see them go through the door, and then they go to the smaller part of the Quest Lab, and you know, it's a small diameter. Then they close that, looks like a big garage door, and decompressurize them. Well, if you were to go outside that door, open it up, take a look back, these gigantic oxygen tanks and nitrogen tanks. They bought up extra ones, you know, on the final shuttle mission, knowing that they weren't coming back. They bought these things up. But now to resupply them, you need these refill tanks. And actually, they stripped out these old oxygen tanks from the old shuttles, and they're using those, you know, instead of making new ones and loading them up with oxygen before they bring them up. Back to you there.
Repeater, time out.
Are these great big oxygen tanks stored on the outside of the International Space Station? I would guess that's the right place. If it started leaking on the outside, other than the fact you're losing some oxygen, it would be safe. If it started leaking on the inside, some bad things can happen. And on the outside, even if it gets cold and the oxygen in the tank turns into liquid, that's not bad. It's still a very good, very efficient way of storing it. So are these great big oxygen tanks stored on the outside of the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
They're surrounding that last room before you go out and do an EVA. On the outside, oxygen tanks and nitrogen tanks. So, it's quite large. And that International Space Station to give you an idea how big this thing is. And they've got 6 jet engines attached to it. So I'm looking forward to this thing flying. It's being built by Paul Allen, one of Microsoft's original owners. It's another one of these billionaire deals. It's great you got all these billionaires involved. Back to you, Dick.
And that 300 and some odd foot wing with 2 fuselages, that's a kind of a carrier. In other words, that's going to be used for transporting other spacecraft. Is that true, Paul? KQLIW?
Yeah, they're going to transport rockets. You know, Orbital ATK will give them a Pegasus rocket. Pegasus rocket has been used for years, normally dropped from the L-1011 carrier. It's not going to be used, you know, this company plans on using it for other people too that would want to use it. So it's going to be multi-purpose. Probably eventually, I wouldn't be surprised if Sierra Nevada with their Dream Chase used it too. But yeah, that's what this is. He took a couple of old 747s and took their engines. So that it's really comprised of 6 747 engines, you know, 3 on each side. And you'll be able to carry this Pegasus rocket, drop it. Pegasus rocket would light up and take off and go into space. Pegasus, you might remember, is the one that launched New Star, which is a satellite it's a telescope that takes pictures of, you know, in the X-ray portion of the band. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of nitrogen, the atmosphere you and I are exposed to at sea level is approximately 20 or 21% oxygen, and the majority of the rest of it is nitrogen. Is that the exact same mixture the astronauts are breathing on the space station? And are they breathing it at 14.7 pounds per square inch? That's question number 2. And question number 3, is the nitrogen that they're breathing also recovered? Is there a recovery procedure for it, or do they have to bring up bottles of nitrogen periodically? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
I think nitrogen being inert, you know, when you inhale it and you exhale it, I think the proportion always stays the same. Have to check with the medical group on that one. But I don't think you need to constantly replenish it, although they do have the tanks up there. Where it's, of course, different with oxygen. And the pressure is 14.7 pounds. It's the same proportion that we have here on Earth, you know, with nitrogen and oxygen. The only difference is, you know, that 1% of what argon and, you know, other things that we inhale naturally here on Earth is not there. So it's just the oxygen and nitrogen mixture. And that's exactly the same as what we have here. And that's the same as, you know, when SpaceX goes up there with a crew, eventually you're going to have the same on board that, and that's the way it's going to work. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so what human beings breathe out is carbon dioxide and nitrogen. The process by which you separate out the carbon dioxide, operate on it to separate out the oxygen, and make water by mixing it with hydrogen, I'd like to believe in that process you're getting your nitrogen back. And so, in theory, very little nitrogen has to be replenished. And I presume they're trying to move into the direction where everything is recycled. The fluids that come out of a human being are going to be recycled. The solid material, I'm pretty sure, is not going to be recycled. But if you could recycle everything that a person exhales, fluids that come out of a human being. In theory, very little materials would have to be brought up from Earth. Is that roughly true, Paul? Are they moving in that direction to try to make almost everything recycled? WS2N, K2RAW?
At times I was listening to Kate Rubin today. She's on board the space station. And mentioned that in an interview with NPR Radio that everything is being recycled pretty much. So, I know there are supplies being brought up, but it's gotten to the point where it's not everything, it's not 100% loop. They're still replacing, they still need more hydrogen to compensate for that loss. From what I heard there, she just said everything is being recycled. So it's pretty amazing. And you're going to need to do that if you want to go to Mars, of course. So they get better at it all the time. And by the time they're ready to go to Mars, they think they'll have it down packed. Because I think that's a decade or two away. Back to you, Dick.
Of the oxygen that gets recovered from either carbon dioxide or from electrolysis, is any of that compressed to storage? Is question number one. And so the compressed bottles of oxygen, that's what you want to make sure it's there so you can always have it immediately available. The amount of backup oxygen, is it 1 month's worth, 3 months' worth? What length of time of backup oxygen do they already have in bottles? What amount of buffer of oxygen would they like to have at all times? WS2N, K2RAW?
I think they said they get low if it's like 4 months, so I think it's normally 6 months. And that's for a six-person crew. For the last month or so, you've had a three-person crew. Because the other Soyuz didn't go up. They found a short there. And one of the landing pieces of equipment, so like I said before. So now, you've already got a reduced crew. I mean, that's not really a good thing, because it cuts back on the amount of science. They spend a lot more time maintaining the space station. So you really need that six-person crew, although that's going to be cut back down to five. The Russians are going to cut it down to five next year. They'll only be sending two people up instead of three on a Soyuz craft. And I don't think there's anybody that is willing to pay the $50 million per seat now to get up there, I think it is. So, they are a reduced crew, so, right now they could probably go easily 6 months, I'm guessing. Even recently they said that somewhere about 6 months ago they said it was if they went down to 4 months that they would consider it themselves getting low.
So they try to keep 6 months backlog of oxygen. Do they worry equally about nitrogen? If worse comes to worse and they ran out of nitrogen, it would be uncomfortable but not dangerous. Is that true, Paul? K2RAW?
Yeah, I've never heard that they've been even worried about nitrogen, so I don't know if that's a problem. So I know they got plenty on board. Again, they have the nitrogen tank attached to that quest lab, but don't forget that, they pull a vacuum on that last piece, which really isn't that much. It's like a two-room module. Really be their EVA module. So they'll put the two astronauts in and decompressurize that. That has to be made up every time they do it. Now, I don't know if they're taking that oxygen or that air and pumping it into a tank temporarily and putting it back. I don't know. But I know they got the nitrogen tanks there. So that all has to be replenished equally. time they do an EVA. That's about it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you're on the space shuttle and you're in the airlock, you've got to bring the air pressure in the airlock down to zero before you open the door and let the astronaut go outside. Is that air in the airlock just vented to the outside, or do they pump it back into the living quarters? It's question number one. And a similar airlock on the International Space Station. Do they vent that to the outside, or do they take the air and pump it out of the airlock into the living quarters or into a tank? Because every time you do an EVA, you're losing a considerable volume of air, oxygen, nitrogen. I'm guessing if this is the best of all worlds, they don't want to vent it to the outside. They want to evacuate that airlock. Is that true, Paul? By pumping it to some place where they can still use it. WS2N, K2LAW.
I don't really know for sure, but my guess is they probably pump it back into a tank. Or maybe back into the living space itself. It goes quite quick, though, when they do it. You know, when they start depressurizing. I mean, inside of, I guess it probably takes them a half hour. They're out the door, less than that, maybe 20 minutes. So they do that pretty quick. I don't know. Good question, but I really don't know for sure what they do with that. I can't imagine them dumping it outside. That would be a waste. Back to you, Dan.
I'm going to make a guess on this one, Paul. In the case of the International Space Station, I'm going to guess they pump the air out of the airlock down to 80 or 90% vacuum, because you can pump that pretty fast. If you wanted complete hard vacuum, you'd have to pump forever, and you're not recovering that much, and a lot of effort is required. So my guess is they pump out 80%, either into the living quarters or into a tank, and then the last few percent they vent to the outside air, because the outside air will immediately give you a hard vacuum. Whereas for you to try to pump a hard vacuum, it would take a month of Sundays. Does that sound reasonable, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but I would go with that system. And they do really have to wait till it gets to a good vacuum toward the end. You know, sometimes you'll hear them talking about, you know, how much pressure is left. They go by bars and millibars. And that last little bit does take a while. But even if there's a little bit, even if 1 pound, if you have 1 pound of pressure on there, you probably could not open that door. Because collectively, on that big round door, which is probably a meter in diameter, That's probably a lot of, probably should try to pull a lot of new ones. I mean, that's got to be really down to zero.
I agree. The astronauts on the lunar module had that problem. No matter how long they waited for the air to run out, it was still very difficult to open the door. They had to literally pry the door. 1 pound per square inch. There's a lot of square inches in a meter diameter portal. So that's a huge amount of pounds. So you got to get it to very low numbers. Now, the modern day International Space Station is coming closer and closer to recycling everything. In the very early days, I am guessing very little recycling took place. They were breathing oxygen out of bottles that they brought up, and probably nitrogen out of bottles they brought up. And the human beings were continuously exhaling carbon dioxide. Does that mean in the early days, the space station was continuously venting the excess pressure to the outside world? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, they were dumping all the hydrogen out. That was definitely being dumped out, and anything that they needed was all coming vehicles back then. Before they had the saboteur machine, you still had the ATV machine, the automatic transfer vehicle from European Space Agency that was launched by the Ariane 5 rocket out of French Guiana, and there was a total of 5 of them. They went up roughly once a year, and they were large. They carried about 3 times the amount of mass than what the Progress could carry. So that was really something. And they had plenty of fuel on board to raise the space station up. And, very interesting. Yes, about fuel cells last week, too. And the conversation went into the fuel cells to go for the water. So I looked into that as well. And the shuttle had 12 kilowatt capability on board the orbiter, compared to the early flights of Gemini. It was first used in the early Gemini flights. Back to you, Dick.
So the fuel cells on the shuttle, 12 kilowatts. Wow. Whereas Apollo, I'm sure, is a small fraction of that. Do we know enough about a fuel cell, at least for the design of the ones that we're using on Apollo, that if they ever turned it off, they couldn't turn it back on? And is that true of the fuel cells that were on the shuttle? If you ever turned it off or turned it down, you couldn't turn it back on? I wonder if we know anything about that yet, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
They started them up about a half hour or so before the flight. And then it would take them about, they said, 7 minutes before they got up to the point where they would be usable, but to be on the safe side before launch, they would start them up at least a half hour before. They can shut them down. I know we've talked about that last week. They were talking about Apollo 13, and they said they didn't want to restart it because they were using the oxygen, and they believed at that time that the oxygen tank had blown up, and they didn't want to turn a fuel cell on to see if the remaining oxygen would work because they didn't know what was wrong. They thought that they would blow up their last tank. But you can't shut them off. And the earliest flight to ever have the fuel cell was Gemini 5, Conrad and Cooper. Cooper had flown before, so it was his second flight. Conrad was, of course, was new at the time. Eventually, Conrad, he got the second ride to the moon on Apollo 12, but during the Gemini 5, they did have the first fuel cells, and the earlier flights, Mercury and Gemini 3, Gemini 4, ran on batteries when we dropped them. So they couldn't have long missions, and they needed to prove that they could run at least 8 days if they wanted to eventually be able to go to the moon. They needed to know that capability was there. So they got in the Gemini two-man capsule and spent almost eight days up in orbit. But the only way you could do that, you couldn't do it on batteries. You only last 24 hours. So that's where they first tested out the fuel cell. And compared to the 12 kilowatts, that's peak kilowatts. The average was 7. On the shuttle, but the kilowatts on board Gemini was 1.5 kilowatts. And they did have problems. Let me drop it. When they first got up there, you run fuel cells high pressure, like 800 pounds per square inch or something. The early fuel cells ran very high pressure. And they, Cooper noticed that the pressure was very low, down to like 50 pounds or something. They got worried about it, he shut it down, and they almost had a very short mission. They could have run on batteries. It would have been 24 hours, back to the Atlantic, back to the Pacific. They started going back to the Pacific then, but on 5. So what they did is, mission control told them to turn them back on again and see what happens. they ran flying on lower pressure, and they completed their 8-day mission. Back to you.
If they ran at the lower pressure, does that mean they got less watts output? Did they ever find out why this one was running lower pressure than it was supposed to? Was it just some kind of a valve, a metering valve failure? Over here, Paul.
Oh, they probably found out, but I've never come across that. They ran it with fresh, and they realized it would work fine on low pressure. So I don't know what was behind that. But yeah, it could have been a venting valve or something probably stuck open. I guess that's probably what will happen. You know, you do have venting valves on these things too. In case there's problems, you know, maybe like a relief valve, and something probably gets stuck open. So, you know, every flight after that, they always ran that fuel cells. And now they're not doing that. Like on the new Orion spacecraft, when I read they're not running fuel cells, they're going to use solar panels. Same with SpaceX and Boeing with their Starliner. I just don't know why they're not going back to fuel cells. I think it's a great system. You can use it on the moon. You can be able to get a lot of power, you know, especially, you know, during a 2-week lunar night or something. That would help. Back to you, Dick.
So from what you know right now, Paul, can I take a modern-day fuel cell, turn it on and turn it off as many times as I want to, and there's no disadvantage? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, but it doesn't work like a battery, you know. I understand it takes, well, the article I read for the spacecraft, I don't know if it's the Earth version, it's a different, take up to 7 minutes before they come on, so, you know, if I start my generator in the backyard or power failure, you know, I'm good to go the second that engine starts. You're going to have to wait a while. And from what I read, they, you know, they'll start it up a half hour before, so maybe you need some extra time. So now if you have a bunch of batteries on board, I guess you can shut it down for whatever reason. Run on batteries and then turn it back on again. Yeah, why not? Basically, I don't know, but I don't see why not.
Okay, for some reason, when you first turn it on, which I presume that means when you're first pouring hydrogen and oxygen into it, you have to wait 7 minutes before it's up to steam, giving you full electrical power output. Is there some kind of a similar turn-off time? If I stop supplying it hydrogen and oxygen, I presume it'll keep making electricity for a while. Is there any disadvantage of not giving it a continuous load during the turn-off procedure? Does anything bad happen if I run it unloaded or if I run it overloaded, electrically speaking? I know these are crazy questions, but it'd be kind of nice to know, I think. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, I remember seeing the drawing for that, for the Gemini system. The Apollo was similar, but they had this long piece, and that was a piece that had this membrane, and they pushed the oxygen and the hydrogen. The oxygen tank was, you know, half the size of the hydrogen tank, you know, because it was H2O, and then they had a two relatively large battery components. You know, they were probably, I don't know, 2 feet long, you know. Probably by about 1 foot. And two of them also did this whole contraption, you know. This whole contraption was the fuel cells, batteries, the oxygen was tanked with spheres. I don't know, they like to use spheres. I guess it didn't matter in space. And I guess they still do that. I know they had a lot of spheres. is on the shuttle. So I guess due to physics, that's the best way to go. You know, equal pressure all the way around. So that both the oxygen and the hydrogen was big spheres. But I just turning them on and off. They probably left them on. You know, they left it on the whole time after they got the pill on that first Gemini mission. I guess there's no reason to shut them down, but they do produce a lot of water. And I guess you could throttle them now where you don't have to worry about it. Back to you.
The water that comes out of the fuel cell, is that potable water? Does it have to go through some extra filtering and refinement before you can drink it? Back to you, Paul.
Comrade said it tasted bubbly, you know. But they said they did tests and everything when they got back, and they were drinking good water. And I remember seeing demonstrations on the news, probably documentaries on when they were trying to push fuel cell technology, you know, for vehicles. I think Brazil has a whole bunch of them, but they tried to do that here. And there's no way to get, you know, hydrogen for a car. You know, you just don't pull it into the gas station and get, you know, 10 gallons of hydrogen. But if the infrastructure was there, you could do that. You could run it with oxygen in the air. And this demonstration I saw, they had the exhaust on the system that's going into a glass, and a reporter, whoever it might be, I don't remember who it was, would take it and drink it to show that it was perfectly good H2O. I don't know if they did it, but I don't think it would be the same thing as drink the water out of the tap. You know, we have other chemicals that I'm probably more used to. Back to you.
So since Gemini 5, we were using fuel cells. On all of the Apollo missions, we're using fuel cells. They're taking in hydrogen and oxygen, making electricity and water. Was there a special tank set aside to gather that water? Because I can't believe the astronauts are drinking all the water coming out of the fuel cells. Over you, Paul, KQRIW.
I think they did water dumps on the Apollo missions. I think I remember hearing that they would dump some of the water. They didn't have so much they wouldn't know what to do with it. Same with the shuttles. By the time the shuttles got to the dock with the, well, originally the Mir, we had five dockings with Mir, and then eventually with the space station, they had so much water they didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I've heard them talk about in the downlink of audio doing a water dump. Up till now, I assume the water dump was the fluids coming out of human beings. Maybe most of it was really coming out of the fuel cell. Or maybe it's the combination. Maybe the water out of the fuel cells was being used to dilute the fluids coming out of humans before it was being dumped overboard. And I do know that periodically they would have a problem where the water dump port on the space shuttle would occasionally have a chunk of ice that forms on the outside in the vacuum of space. Over you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yep. Oh, yeah. I remember hearing that. And, I know it was, it was both, you know, but I mean, they did dump water from the fuel cell, but you know, that was part of it. That was like a regular system, you know. After a couple of days, they would have to do a water dump. It sounds like such a waste now. Maybe that's why they've gotten away from it. Solar panels nowadays are getting so much better. They don't need that, all that extra piping and everything. So, your way with that. You know, it works good for the Soyuz coming up. They've always had solar panels. And now we're going to have it with Orion. But definitely with SpaceX, with the Dragon crew vehicle. And I'm sure Boeing will too, although I never saw a picture of solar cells. I think I remember Boeing wanted to do everything with batteries. They were going to shoot up there in 6 hours and dock. But I'm not too sure about that. I think they're going to have solar cells. Back to you.
I think Soyuz carries six astronauts, six cosmonauts. I said six, I meant three. I think the Soyuz carries three cosmonauts. My guess is on board there's enough oxygen, hydrogen to run a fuel cell and food. But my guess is when the Soyuz is coming up, there is essentially nothing left over. There is no real cargo being transported by Soyuz. Is all of that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I've read that they bring up 150 pounds of cargo, 150 pounds go back. You know, now they'll be able to bring up more if they bring up a two-person crew. So, mostly everything's brought up on the Soyuz. Soyuz, they have like two versions of the... on the Progress. They have two versions of the Progress. They have one that carries mostly equipment and food and water. Then they have another one. It's almost like a fuel tank, you know. It'll carry a lot of that, you know, provisions, but mostly fuel. The front part of it, if it was a... It looks like the Soyuz. So you have three parts of the Soyuz. You have the crude section, the orbital section in the front, and the service module in the back. The front part, the orbital section, is big spherical tanks of fuel that refuel the space station. So they have two versions of that. But yeah, on the Soyuz, you only get maybe a couple hundred pounds, I guess, of supplies. It's very cramped. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of what these people look like when they're coming up. It doesn't look too comfortable.
If I understand correctly, Soyuz is capable of carrying three human beings from Earth up to the International Space Station. Do they ever go up with two human beings and the third location carries extra cargo? Question number one. And when Soyuz comes back down, does it always come down with three humans, or could it come down with two humans? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, they've gone up with three, and at one point they were going up with two. I believe after the 2003 explosion of Columbia, I think they made a couple of two-person flights. But, now they're going to go back to two this year, starting 2017, really. They're going to start with just two going up instead of three, just for about a year or so until the MLM gets delivered to space. The MLM is another module that the Russians have been working on for probably 2007. They thought it was going to go up, but it's been delayed for many, many reasons. And that will have it's another large module, and that will be sent up by a proton rocket, and will dock it, you know, independently. Well, their modules always dock autonomously, and then once that's done, then they'll go back to a three-person crew. Too expensive. They don't need to do it. They can't do the amount of science that they wanted to do. So they're going to switch from three to two. So on a regular basis, we'll have a five-person crew for the next year or so on board. Right now, you have three. There's only three up there right now. Back to you, Ben.
When Soyuz goes up, it's got a crew quarters and it's got a service module. oxygen, hydrogen, water, fuel cells, and so on. When Soyuz docks with International Space Station, could they, in the worst situation, put three astronauts in and come straight back down again? Or does the service module need some refurbishing in order to go back down when they dock with the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Waiting for a tone. There we go. You have the three sections of the Soyuz. The crew version, the crew part of it is the centerpiece, center of it. When they get launched, that's what they're in, and when they land, that's what they're in. The orbital section is the piece in front. After you take off, you get out of your seats, you can get out of your flight gear, and you can start floating around the orbital module. They have food up there and bathroom. That's the where the docking port is when they dock with the space station, and the service module is in the back. And like you said, they have all the tank for oxygen, water, fuel. It's where all your thrusters are for maneuvering. And the back part, the service module, and the front part, the orbital part, separate before the orbital part, before the crew version, the crew part of it comes back. And it's ready to go. I mean, you can get out of the space station and disconnect immediately. A berthing situation, berthing module, would take probably, 8 to 24 hours to undock something like that. But you can get out right away. They use it as a lifeboat. Let me drop it. And that's why the Soyuz craft has to be good for, I think, 240 days. And so you can stay attached to the space station independently for all that time. But it does plug into it. It does plug into the space station to keep everything charged from the solar cells. But when you disconnect, you go through the hatch and get into your three seats, and you can disconnect right away. And the same is going to hold true for the Starliner being built by Boeing and the crew version of the Dragon built by SpaceX. Again, they'll be able to be attached for, 240 days. And that'll be the lifeboat. So however many people you have on board the space station, there's always a seat to go home if there's a problem. You're not going to leave somebody behind. Back to you, Dick.
When Soyuz goes up with, say, three people, in the center module is the crew quarters with the three people. The back end is the service module with thrusters, oxygen, hydrogen, water tanks, all that stuff. The forward section is called the orbital section. When Soyuz comes back down, are there the same three sections? Command module, service module, crew quarters, and orbital module. You got three modules going up. When Soyuz comes back down, does it come back down with three modules? Over you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, they disconnect from the space station with all three modules. It's one whole spaceship. But before they re-enter, they'll separate the orbital module. And then at the last minute, they'll separate the service module. So the only thing that's left is the crew module with the heat shield on it. And that's what re-enters. At one time, they actually separated the orbital module and the service module exactly at the same time, but they've given up with that. There was some problems involved with that one time, they said. And so they separate the orbital module, and then they will separate the service module and come back. The Chinese Shenzhou system is built, it kind of looks like the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. And the only difference there is when the orbital module separates, they have scientific equipment on board. They leave that in orbit, and so the orbital part stays unmanned in orbit, and they use it as a functioning satellite for purposes, for their own purposes. The Russians don't do that. They just let that thing burn up in the atmosphere, along with the service module.
When Soyuz comes back down, all three modules leave the International Space Station. Somewhere on the way down, you disconnect the service module and you disconnect the orbital module. Do those two disconnected modules burn up on re-entry? Do they survive the re-entry? Do they get recovered? Do they have their own parachutes? What happens to those two jettisoned modules? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
They burn up, and that's it for them. And I guess if anything makes it to the ground, I guess it would probably land somewhere in Kazakhstan. And that's where they come down with their parachutes. So they don't survive. So that's the way that goes. And the same with Progress. Progress, they just burn up the whole thing. They deorbit that over the Pacific, and that completely burns up. And that's what's going to happen to Cygnus. That's what the Cygnus spacecraft does. But now Cygnus, before that thing comes down, we're using that as a test bed, and there's all kinds of things going on for a couple of weeks before they actually deorbit that. Back to you, Dick.
It's my guess, Paul, if Elon Musk was redesigning Soyuz, those two modules would have a heat shield and parachute, and maybe even thrusters. He wouldn't let them burn up. He'd be recovering those, in my opinion, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know that. That's his goal, eventually, to recover everything. He'd like to recover the second stage. Not easy. But he definitely plans on doing it with the Dragon. Plans on eventually bringing crew back without parachutes. Propulsion landing. Put your retros on and deorbit. And come back with just the Super Draco engines. Eight of them, banks of two, four sets, and he plans on bringing them all the way down to the ground like that. That's his ultimate goal, so we'll see. That would be next, and then somewhere down the line, I guess he'd work on trying to bring back the second stage. But he'd be happy to do that. The next thing he's going to try to save is the fairings. He's going to attach parachutes to the fairings and save those things. That's probably, 6 months away. Let's see if he can, he's got to get back to flight again after this last disaster on September 1st when he flew up on launch bay. I still haven't heard any confirmation of what it is. He had theories, but I don't know what it is yet. You don't know what it is, you can't fix it.
Are you saying he hasn't published any of the results of the investigation yet, Paul? Go ahead.
No, he's pointing to the second stage. Probably the helium tank exploding, which was the same problem that they had 2 Junes ago when it blew up on CRS number 7. They blew up the cargo. It was a cargo mission going up to the space station, and that, they said, was a strut that broke loose, and they blamed everything on that. Let the helium tank loose. Helium tank oxygen tank inside the second stage. Of course, and that thing was to get the whole thing to explode, the whole rocket. And here, the whole rocket blew up, but they're saying, no, it's not the strut this time. It's, and, you know, they really don't know. They don't know. So, you know, they're saying they're going to be back to flight at the end of November. I don't see that. You have to find out what the problem is in that second.
And you and I have to hope that he has enough test points that he can review all the data and figure out what was happening. In the case of Soyuz going up, on the way up, the astronauts are being maintained by all of the consumables and electrical power and everything else that's in the service module. On the way back down, one of the early things you do is to jettison the service module and the orbital module. Therefore, the astronauts during the whole reentry are being maintained by tanks of oxygen, water, they're being, and batteries. In other words, the Soyuz crew quarters have to be thoroughly self-sustaining on the way back down. I presume none of the consumables in the crew quarters are used on the way up, because you want that to be left over on the way down. On the way up, everything is maintained by way of the service module. Bunch of guesses on my part. Am I close, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I know it happens quick. You know, the service module has the thrusters that are going to, you know, the retro firing. And that's going to slow everything down. And then once you start, you know, start deorbiting, you know, close the atmosphere, then you separate the orbital module, and then right after that, the service module, and then probably minutes later, you start coming down. So now you're on whatever life support you have inside the crewed part of that vehicle, which is, you know, there's no solar panels anymore, there's no nothing. You're running on battery power, and you've got some more thrust to try to keep this thing, the attitude right, as you know, try to keep the heat shield going in the right direction. Enough power to release the parachutes, and right before landing, there was a solid rocket that fired just for a split second right before they hit the ground to try to soften the landing. But they do land on ground back there. And we're running out of time. Look at this, WS2M.
Yes, we are. I've got a couple more questions, but this was TechNet number 1,622. And space report number 222. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Pass it over to John for any final comments he wants to make. WS2N. I mean, KC2WGB. K2RIW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Thank you, Dick. Yep, another good net, and some good things are happening. And for a night like tonight, I didn't think we'd have that much, but I guess not everybody's watching the debates. Maybe they'll replay it later, but I wish everybody to tune in again next week, and we shall have some more fun. And do some good things, and have some fun. That's what this hobby's about. Good night, Paul. Good night, Dick. You guys have a great time. KC2WGB. Paul, over to you.
A quick question, if you can squeeze it in, Paul. Have you ever worried what would happen when you try to jettison on the way back down, try to jettison the service module and the orbital module, if they didn't disconnect? My guess is life gets pretty complicated pretty fast. Over to you, Paul. KQRIW.
I said earlier, they had a problem. They used to do it exactly at the same time.